welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. New ABCA podcast sponsor Driveline are longtime friends, and I've used many of their products when I was coaching in the youth camps now. If you want to truly optimize your pitcher's workload, Pulse from Driveline Baseball takes simple pitch counts to the next level. Pulse is a wearable sensor that precisely measures every throw your pitchers make on a daily basis. Pulse tracks both throw count and throw intensity. Trusted by MLB organizations like the Cincinnati Reds, elite college programs, and individual athletes at all levels, Pulse is changing the way throwing workload is managed. With the Pulse Team dashboard, you'll be able to make data-driven usage decisions to optimize training and injury prevention for your entire team. Visit drivelinebaseball.com/pulse to revolutionize your pitching staff's development and health today. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. Continuing our 2026 ABCA Hall of Fame class interviews, Sam Peraro forged a storied coaching career spanning high school, junior college, and NCAA Division I baseball, leaving an indelible mark at every level. From 1980 to 1986, he served as head coach at Mission College, where he built the baseball program from the ground up. During his 7 years in Santa Clara, Peraro's Saints captured 2 state championships while collecting 5 Coast Conference titles. He then took the helm at San Jose State, leading the Spartans from 1987 to 2002, and again from 2004 to 2012. Peraro guided San Jose State to its first ever College World Series appearance in 2000, and he finished as the school's all-time wins leader with an 806-632 record and a 996-702 overall collegiate record. His tenure also included 4 Western Athletic Conference Coach of the Year awards and 2 NCAA tournament berths. Ending his head coaching career with a 4-year stint at Willow Glen High School from 2015 to 2018, he remains one of California's most respected coaching figures. Peraro's coaching accomplishments earned him significant recognition, beginning in 1996 when he became the second youngest coach ever inducted into the California Community College Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame. His legacy was further honored with his inclusion in the inaugural class of the Mission Athletics Hall of Fame in 2021, and the San Jose Sports Hall of Fame in 2022. Let's welcome Sam Peraro to the podcast. All right, here is Sam Peraro, 2026 ABCA Hall of Fame inductee, but head coach at Mission College, then San Jose State, but then finished up at Willow Glen High School, but also in the 3C2A Hall of Fame as well. So, Sam, thanks for jumping on with me.
Ryan, great to be on. Thank you for asking me.
Yes, sir. Hey, after San Jose State, when you finished, did you get right into coaching there?
Yeah, you know, actually, I've been ongoing for 52 years. When I left San Jose State, I actually went back to Mission College. A friend of mine who was the head coach asked me if I wanted to get into teaching there part-time, and I went ahead and did that. And while I was doing that, he asked me if I would join him on his coaching staff. So I ended up coaching there for 2 years, 2013 and 14. And then I was contacted by Willow Glen High School, which, you know, I'm about 10 minutes away from. And I had never coached high school before, so it was my first experience. And I coached at Willow Glen for 4 years, had a great time. And then when my wife retired, I gave up head coaching and then started to do a little bit of a coach with my brother for 3 years. And now I'm coaching with my son and my former players at San Jose State at Mitty. So I'm still getting after it.
How's it been with coaching with family members?
Well, you know, it's always good to have, you know, my son was my director of operations the last, I think, 4 or 5 years at San Jose State. He had a tough job. He had to kind of do a lot of the grunt work. So we got a chance to see what goes on behind the scenes. And he, you know, loves coaching, loves baseball. And so I get to see him every day at the, you know, at the field, which is fun. And like I told you, the coaching staff there is all San Jose State players. So guys that I coached, they had to put up with me for, you know, 4 years, and now they bossed me around.
But that says something about how you treated them.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, they were not just great players, but, you know, they were outstanding students, people. Enjoyed their experience, which certainly helps. You know, I wasn't real easy on them, but they took it to the level that they needed to, and they're doing very well. So I'm just glad to be part of it, Ryan.
From the outside now, you know, what's changed for you with coaching? You know, you've seen over 50 years of it. What's changed with coaching now?
Well, I think now, especially with the advent of travel ball being so big, anytime you're teaching, you know, anytime you're trying to talk about a topic, explain a fundamental or a philosophy, you have to go into a lot of detail on the why part. I think you really have to sell why you believe in what you're doing. It used to be, you know, when I broke in and even the first 10, 15 years, a coach basically said, I'd like you to do this. This is how we want to do it. And you expected the player to do it. But now, you know, they can get on YouTube. You know, they can have access to other voices. And so you have to be, I think, a better teacher, just a better communicator in terms of the teaching part.
Did you get started coaching JV at San Jose State? Was that your start?
So in 1973, which was my redshirt year at San Jose State, the head coach brought me in at the end of the season and said, you know, he recommended that I may not make the team next year. And he said, but I want to ask you if you would be interested in being our head freshman coach. Back then, there was it was just freshman teams. It was a league here in the Bay Area. It was called the Bay Area Collegiate League. And that included Stanford, Santa Clara, Cal, USF, St. Mary's, San Jose State. And I had played on that in that league, but he asked me, would you like to do it? Asked me how many more years of school I had. I mean, it was a good discussion. I was honored that he asked me. I was 20 at the time, and I would be 21 by the time the season. So I went ahead, jumped in. You know, I always studied the game, so I felt I was one step ahead of the players, but I had a really good group that year. We ended up winning that league, which, you know, I looked at it and go, man, this is pretty easy. I think I'll keep on doing this. And then I found out it wasn't that easy. But I continued doing that for the next 2 years while I finished my degree. And then the head coach asked me if I would join him on the varsity staff, and he would help me start on my master's. And I, you know, there again, I wasn't getting paid, but I was getting paid with experience. He allowed me a lot of leeway. And I assisted him for 3 more years as his number one assistant. And I had the unique opportunity to actually coach. As you know, I was 24 at the time. Coached third base, gave the signs, gave the defenses, ran practice. He trusted me. And it was a great experience for me.
Was it difficult coaching guys your own age?
Yes, originally it was. And so I had to coach. So in the fall of 73, I had to coach two of my roommates that I was living with. One was a pitcher and one was an infielder. And, of course, they would quiz me, you know, at times and say, hey, which coach thing, you know. They kind of wanted inside information. And so I kind of learned at that age, at 21, that, you know, I can't serve two masters, right? I explained to them, I go, hey, you know, sorry, guys. You know, if you don't want to hang around with me, that's okay. But, Coach Mingus, I work for Coach Mingus. So it was a little unusual. Let's just put it that way.
At what point did the Mission College job open up for you then?
So in April of 1979, which was my last year, as it turned out, at San Jose State, our head coach had a flyer, and he looked at me because he knew that I was looking for full-time employment now. Because, you know, San Jose State didn't pay for their assistant coaches. That's just the way it was. And even when I became the head coach, that was still the case. And he said, this school is opening up. It's brand new, and they're looking for a coach, and I think you should apply for it. I'll write a letter for you, blah, blah, blah. So to make a long story short, I was one of 12 finalists, and I wasn't the most qualified. I know I wasn't. There were some really good people in that group. But I think they hired me because I was young. I was still single at the time. And I had Division I experience, and they felt maybe that would help them get that program going. So I was fortunate. I got the job. I spent 7 years at Mission. Had a great time. I was there from age 26 to 33, and we did a lot of good things there. So it was a great experience.
Two state championships?
Yes, 81 and 83. We had a great team in 85, and Mike Gillespie, who went on to coach at USC. Mike was the coach at College of the Canyons and had a great JC program, and he eliminated us. I had the honor of coaching against Mike in junior college for almost every one of those 7 years. We would be in tournaments and so on. And I tell you what, Ryan, to this day, I think he's one of the greatest game day coaches that I ever went against. Just a really good tactician. Even though he was an infielder, he handled the pitching. He called the games, controlled the games. And we ended up he got the SC job like a week before I got the San Jose State job back in 1986. So we had a lot of commonalities.
Where did you start when you were building the Mission program? Where's the first place you started?
Well, since there was no team, there was no field, first thing I did was, and at that time I was working in the cannery, because since I didn't get paid at State, my dad told me, hey, you know, you need to get a summer job. And I worked at Del Monte Corporation's, a pickle factory, and I would work minimum 10 to 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So what I would do is, when I got the Mission job, I got off about 7 at night, and then immediately went to 4 or 5 sites that summer ball was going on. There were, you know, in our area, we had 4 or 5 sites going on almost every night. And so I'd go down, and I could still remember the first player I ever contacted. He was a young man who was from Wilcox High School in Santa Clara. And I introduced myself and asked him about Mission College, because I had called every high school coach in my district to get names of seniors. That was the first thing. 8 coaches in that district, I got every senior, and then I got their numbers. We didn't have cell phones back then, and I just went to work. Anyway, this one individual looked at me and he says, well, I have 2 questions for you. Who are you? And what's Mission College? And I just remember that. And he was the first player that really, accepted my invitation to come over there, start that program.
Did you have to stay within district to recruit?
Correct. We're in the same district as West Valley, and they were on the west side, and we were near Santa Clara, near Santa Clara University. But we all had the same schools. So I could not go out of my area and recruit a player. I mean, it's, you know, obviously today it's a different ball game, but back then you could get into trouble if you went outside your district. And let's say somebody from out of the district contacted me, I'd have to go to my AD Well, eventually I became the AD. So I, you know, I had to go through a channel of information, fill out, hey, so-and-so called me. I'm going to now initiate communication with him. So the rules were very strict back then.
Was the goal always to go back to San Jose State?
That's a great question. While I was at Mission, I was offered the St. Mary's job in 1985 in Moraga. And I actually, it was the fall. The coach there had resigned to take a job with the Colorado Rockies in the scouting department, Tom Wheeler, just an outstanding baseball man. And they contacted me, and I actually drove up with my assistant at the time and spent the day in Moraga. Great campus, great area. But the fly in the ointment was I had to move. Okay, they would have required a move, even though it was about an hour and 15-minute drive. The AD was adamant. And so, you know, my wife, you know, had a good job here. She was actually the breadwinner for us early on, and she couldn't make the transfer, so I did turn the job down. And I stayed at Mission, and yes. And I interviewed for the Santa Clara job in 86, or 85, and John Oldham got it. John got that job. I was a runner-up, so the San Jose State job opened in June of 86, and then, yes, but I always thought going back to San Jose State would be a dream for me. If you ask me, hey, you know, pick a job, it would have been that. I just didn't want to, bug Gene about when is he going to leave? You know, hey, when are you going to retire? I just kind of waited for him to. He called me one day and said, Coach, I'm gonna step down and I want you to apply for it. And that process started, you know, trying to decide whether I wanted to leave a great job at Mission. I was the AD there, department chair. I was assistant dean of students. And I was the head baseball coach. So I had a really good job. And, I actually took a pay cut when I went to San Jose State.
How much of the coaching path, coaching journey, do you think is affected by family situations?
That's a great question. I can tell you that in my situation, and there again, you know, I had some opportunities to leave the area, and my family, you know, our parents from here and we love this area. And I wasn't going to say, hey, let's pack up and let's go over here. But we never had to move. I think that's kind of unusual, and it was a blessing. We did not have to move. And not every coach can say that.
When did you start to develop the playbook?
So, in 1976, the fall of 76, would have been my first fall with the varsity. I put together a playbook. That's what I called it. And I wasn't married yet, but Joanne, who is my wife now, she ended up typing every page of it. Get this, every page, and then mimeographed about 80 copies. And so I told our head coach, I said, Coach, I'd like to give every one of these players this. And then I think you said you'd let me, you know, run practices, but I'd like to have some meetings. And every player had a playbook, and we went over, you know, the only thing that wasn't in there, Ryan, were signs. Because just in case, you know, maybe you cut somebody or whatever, if the signs could get into the wrong hand. So we had everything in there, every offensive play, every cutoff, relay, pickoff, philosophy. It was a very detailed playbook, and that was my first one that I ever did.
When did you start to add things like core values and some of the other stuff? Because I think it was always started with team stuff, on the field stuff, but I think over time it evolved into the life skills portion of that.
No doubt. And you know, we tried to identify four or five things that we wanted our program to stand for. Okay. And of course, we asked the players to live up to that. And I had a vocabulary list, which today I even use that today when our coach lets me get involved with that. And I always thought that was critical during a game, especially when you could maybe just have a word that could mean exactly what we kind of wanted to do. So along with that, we came up with a vocabulary and proved to be, very helpful and effective for the players.
Yeah, because you have respect, trust, pride, attention to detail, and toughness.
Correct. And those things, to me, stand the test of time. I mean, I think in 20 years, those things would still hold. And I quiz the players a lot. You know, we had baseball IQ tests that we issued, and that was always a question that they knew would be on there. They had to, in detail, talk about those things and why they were significant for our program at that time. So I believe in that stuff, to be honest with you. I think they're helpful for the players, and it helps your program overall.
How do you address that with players when they're maybe not upholding those standards?
Well, I think the key is teaching and trying to make sure they understand why you have that. Because words can get, a young man looks at that and says, okay, yeah, he has to say that. But I think we would spend a lot of time breaking down exactly what that was. And so if we did have somebody go, let's say somebody was late, had a propensity for not meeting, the guidelines of time, which was always my number one rule. And I always felt that was the one thing I wanted our players to understand is the value of being on time, because it was respect for other people. And on occasion we might run into something like that. And I would bring that person in and make sure that they understood why that was a big deal. Now, back then you could do more things. I mean, we ran guys a lot. Okay. I'm going to plead guilty on that.
I played in that era.
Okay. Since I hated to run, I used that. Okay. And our players, I had an assistant coach who was our conditioning guy, and they were terrified of him because he was tougher than I was. And I tell you what, I will argue with certain people that those types of things, they do deter, they prevent people from making those types of mistakes. And so they got the point. Let's just put it that way.
I like the fact that you put in there applies to everyone in the program.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's assistant coaches too. That's everybody. Our staff was, I still believe hiring is one of the most important things anybody can do. You've got to be able to have good people that believe in what you're doing. They trust what you're trying to teach, and you're developing them too. I mean, you're not just developing, but at San Jose State, we're a developmental program. See, today, Ryan, I don't know how I function in the portal situation, NIL, because we believed in bring a high school kid in, and, his first year might be a total learning experience, and he may not play a lot. He may even redshirt, but by his second year, he was ready to go, and by his junior year, he can help the young guys coming in. So we kind of wanted to develop our guys so they in turn could help new freshmen coming in. So they understood the system and what that system meant and why that system existed.
You mentioned Mike Gillespie. Did your in-game stuff change by having a coach against him?
Well, I know this. I never dropped my head. I was in full paying attention mode. And I'll give you some games that we played. I remember a game they beat us 1-0 at the the Hancock JC tournament in Santa Maria. And this is for the championship game of that tournament. They had great teams in there. They always would bring in the best Southern California teams and the teams from Northern California. And he had a 1-0 lead in the bottom of the eighth. I made a trip to the mound. I said, he's going to try to steal home flat out. So I'll let you wind up. But I want you to make sure you check before. And if he breaks, the hitter's not going to swing. So just throw a strike. And son of a gun. And he had a real fast guy there. And he tried to steal home. And we got him. And I was really happy about that. That because Mike was that type of coach. He'd pull everything. He had some great pickoffs. If you were half asleep on the second base, they'd get you. So to answer your question, you're not only your preparation, but your attention to every pitch had to be at the top, just so he wouldn't take advantage of you.
I like the fact that you have a code of competition too, just as kind of a reminder for in-game stuff too for players.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's beautiful about baseball is there's no clock in terms of they got to get 27 outs or in high school 21 outs, and the bottom line is human nature kind of is built in on two factors. One, it's easy to give up and it's easy to ease up. So if you're playing marbles with somebody and you're beating the crap out of them and I got this one, you back off a little bit, the other person comes back and beats you because you eased up. And same goes about giving up. Baseball allows you to compete and stay involved, and every out becomes valuable. I told the players, let me worry about the etiquette. Let me worry about winning, not to steal or squeeze or whatever. I'll handle that part. I know how to do that, but you play hard. In other words, ball's in the dirt and you're on third base and we're up by 7. If you can make it, you go. Because it's an insult, actually, to the other team. I mean, at the Division I level, the good coaches, they want to compete for a full ball game. So the code of competition is that you play, you respect the officials. I never wanted our players talking to the umpires. I told them I was their attorney. And if we had a case, I would argue their case. And if not, let's not worry about it. I wanted them to respect the opponents. When we shook hands after a game, it was a handshake. It wasn't, sometimes you just brush each other's hand. We felt that we had to respect the opponent, whether there was a rivalry or not. I wanted them to respect the game, the umpires, the officials, each other. We're going to get beat. And the question is, did you compete for the duration of the game? That was the question.
Why do you feel like we don't see as much sportsmanship now?
Well, I think because all you got to do is get on TV and watch what goes on. I mean, it's like my son tells me, Dad, things have changed, okay? Just like, I didn't let the guys have long hair. They couldn't have, they had to be groomed. And when I went to MIDI, the school I'm coaching at now, my son warned me. He said, Dad, listen, some of these guys, Coach lets these guys have longer hair, earrings, things like that. And please don't make that a factor. And, since those guys worked for me, I said, God, I they kind of knew how I felt about it. But my point is this, it's things have changed a little bit, but these guys watch on TV, they see the celebrations. I don't personally like them, okay? Every time a guy hits a double, they've got to... I mean, it's kind of fun to watch, but I don't know if, I would encourage that. But again, play the game, be humble. If you hit a home run, get around the bases. You don't need to do jumping jacks and all that stuff. That's old school in me that I think should still be part of the game.
I think as long as it's directed to your own dugout, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, there again, your job as a coach is to make sure you're not getting on the officials. You're not talking to the opponents. That's just rule number one. Worry about your own team. Give them a boost. Do what you have to do, and then there again, the coaches that I had the honor of coaching against, they understood the etiquette of the game, respected the game, and kind of had the same feeling about it as I did. So I got along with those guys great.
Did you feel like the 2000 team had a chance to go to the World Series?
you know, that team was not the best team that I ever had, but they had the best leadership. So the key guys in that group had been in the program since their freshman year and had developed to where they almost were coaches in a sense. So if we went through a rough patch, I always stayed out of the clubhouse, you know, the locker room. I never went in there. I felt that was the players. But I can remember one time I went into the equipment room to turn something in or get a dozen balls, and I heard a voice in there and basically lecturing our players. And it was our team captain. It's our center fielder. And I could have sworn he was coaching. To this day, he's a very successful coach in Southern California. But I said to myself, wow, now that's not easy to do, you know, to talk to your teammates like that and back to coaches like that. I thought that was rare. But we had several of those guys, Ryan. So in that sense, we could take a punch and come back. We can get off the mat maybe better than some of the other teams we had.
That team was tough. That 2000. It was very,
you know, to get to Omaha, they went through. We went to Waco for the region. We had to play, I think, Baylor, Southwest Texas, and Florida. And Baylor was favored to win that, but I thought Florida was the best team talent wise. I really did. And we got stuck playing them. We played them three games, and we were able to shut them down. Our pitching style gave them problems. You know, we had a kind of staff. They didn't throw real hard, but they could really pitch. I had a great pitching coach, and he called the games and did a great job. So we won the first game, I think, 3-1. And then in an elimination where we could eliminate them, we were 2-0. They were 2-1. We've got them by 4 in the ninth with 2 outs and nobody on. Okay, so we're up by 3. It's 7-4, 2 outs, bottom of the ninth. And the third hitter that's up hits a pop fly toward the third base dugout, Florida's dugout. And our third baseman, I thought he was going to catch the ball, and somehow it got in the dugout, and the game went on. And that hitter eventually got a base hit. They got 5 hits in a row and walked us off. They walked us off. And our guys were devastated. Devastated, because they were that close to doing something that was really special. And I tried to explain to them. I said, hey, you know, we got another day tomorrow, but I'll be honest with you, all of us were down. I was down. I don't think I slept a wink that night trying to figure out who was going to pitch the next day, because we basically had a 7-man staff, and we had used the bulk of the guys that, you know, we used to win a series. And we finally settled on a bullpen guy, our setup man, closer. Jared Sandler had never started a game in his career. It was a true story. And I called him on the phone that night, and I said, hey, listen, can you give me a couple tomorrow? Can you get through the lineup one time? And then we'll figure it out after that. So, of course, you know, he, yes, sir, I'll be ready. You know, the guy throws, you know, maybe 79. He might hit 80, but he had a nice little screwball, and he could cut the ball a little bit. So he breezes through the first 3 innings. He breezes through, and we're up 2-0. And I asked the pitching coach, I said, you know, we had guys down there. And he said, coach, we might be able to get a few more out of this guy. So we literally, this one guy pitched in the bullpen 8 innings. Chris Sherman pitched a complete game in the bullpen. He was up every inning. And it turns out this guy, Sandler, went 9 innings. He went the distance. And to this day, I think that's the greatest pitch game in the history of San Jose State, what it did for us to get to the regional. And then we went to Houston, and we suffered the same thing in the second game. We won the first game, and then we got the game won in the ninth inning. were the home team for that game, and we blew a bases loaded opportunity, and then Houston beat us in the 14th. And there again, we were in the same situation. Our guys outfought them the third game. So the toughness that you talked about, it's beyond toughness. They just had great character and resolve. And the key word there is they'd been together 3 years. That was their third year together. A lot of freshmen that were now juniors and seniors.
Did they talk at all about how you – it's really hard for a team. You got a chance to put a team away and you don't. You know, because as a coach, you can talk about it, but the players eventually have to go out and play. You know, did they talk much about that, about being able to overcome that type of adversity?
Well, you know, at our – we had a reunion I believe in 2020, 20-year reunion. And each of them had a chance to get up and talk a little bit. And that came up a half dozen times. Just out of, you know, guys said, you know, the way we bounced back from that game is, you know, they still couldn't figure it out. Because the turnaround was, you know, the game ended late, and then it was an 11 o'clock start, okay? So the turnaround wasn't, maybe that was good. You know, maybe that was good. We just got back in there. Try not to dwell on it. But no, that stuck with them over the years. Their toughness and resiliency. Of course, the pitcher that gave up the four hits against Florida, he gave up four of the five. When we went back to the hotel, he was in the not the stairway, but elevator with his parents, and he was crying like a baby. And our pitching coach and I looked in there, and his dad was on one side, his mom was on the other side, and he was devastated. And I was a little reluctant to go in, but because he had started the game on Friday. That's how we did things on that team. The Friday starter would close on Sunday if the opportunity presented itself. And then the Sunday starter, Tim Adonolfi, he would close on Friday. And they had the arms where they could do that. So today, I think I would get arrested for that, you know. But we did that and got away with it. But I brought Chris in, actually, against Houston. In that same situation, he did a great job and shut him down.
Love it. You got a chance to go back then and coach high school. Are high school kids much different than college kids?
You know, I was reluctant to go back. I'd never done it before. And so what I did, I had four or five friends, trusted coaching friends, that I asked their opinion whether I should do it or not. Two said no, and two said yes. And I was upset with the two guys that said, no, why is that? They go, coach, you know, you can't do the things you did at San Jose State. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. So that kind of motivated me in a sense, well, okay, I got to prove I can do this. But my first meeting that I had, this is with the kids, you know, he had long hair, yeah, he got earrings and this and that. And I told him, I said, you know, I'm not going to worry about that. I go, what I am going to do is, and we had those core values. I go, here's the things that we're going to stick by. And other than that, don't worry about, you know, what you maybe have heard or whatever. Okay, so the first day of practice, I walk in the dugout. Now, we're ready to start. And our assistant coach stopped me. He says, hey, coach, when you walk into the dugout, you're going to be really surprised. I go, oh, man, what does he mean by that? Well, when I walked in, every one of those guys had cut their hair and were not wearing any jewelry at all. So I asked one of the guys, his name was Tyler Randall. I said, Tyler, did I ask you guys, help me out here. I'm getting old, but I still don't remember this. He said, no, coach, we did a little research on you. And we found out that you prefer that the players are groomed and blah, blah, blah. And I looked, and I smiled. I started smiling. I go, I can do this because I didn't even have to make them do that. So to answer your question, I had to win their trust that, A, I cared about them, B, I was going to try to help them, But see, they were going to have to follow the guidelines. So one of the first things they had to learn was no girlfriends after the game. So, you know, we had a, you know, played an away game and the game was over. We would always walk together to the bus as a team. You know, we wouldn't straggle out. We win, lose, or draw. We have like a little unit. And, you know, we got a couple guys with their girlfriends with them. They're going to walk to the bus. And so I had to stop them and say, hey, this isn't lover's lane. You know, when you get back to school, you can see your girlfriends. But we're not done yet. Okay, we get on the bus, blah, blah. So that part of it, I had to deal with on occasion. Other than that, they did what I asked them to do.
The hair thing is a team led thing, though. Like that, I think if you say, "Hey, we're not doing it," they fight you on it. But they come to a consensus as a group. I think they'll do it.
Yeah, no, I mean, there again, you know, leadership is the whole key, and it's not cool to be a leader nowadays like it used to be. You know, leadership's hard. You can't go up to somebody and say, "I want you to be a leader." It doesn't work that way. Now, they can lead by example, but I always thought it was important to have somebody that had the courage to, you know, for example, in stretching before the game, plyometric stretching, I wanted total silence. I wanted total dedication to the 8 minutes that we were doing. Now, you know, there was obviously some times where guys would be carrying on conversation. So I would, whoever was in charge of that area, I'd ask them, I'd go, "Do you have a problem asking the guys for silence? Is that something you're uncomfortable doing? If you are, let me know. I'll put somebody else out there." And they took that as a challenge, and no, they were going to handle that. And they did. And there again, it's a small detail. Somebody might say, "Well, why is that important?" Well, in my mind, it's part of your preparation getting into the competition. It's just part of your prep. And you don't want to be distracted. You can relax on your own. Your mind can work for yourself. I just didn't like distractions or things that I felt might take away from the assignments or how they were going to go about their business.
I think it's another opportunity to practice on getting into flow state too. That's the way you talked about the why. I think that was the why we've tried to explain to our players, is like, this isn't, you wouldn't be talking, fielding a ground ball or throwing a pitch or swinging a bat. It's another opportunity to try to practice to get into flow state and be in the complete present moment. It's just another opportunity with your stretching to be able to get into the present moment.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I mean, you know, you probably did the same thing. You know, you'd have a game day itinerary timed to the second, right? And most of that, now, I always gave our teams 20 minutes of on your own time. And it might be after we hit, it might be before we hit. But my point is that they could relax in the clubhouse or whatever and just, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden they looked up there and said, "Okay, time for this." And we stayed on that. Now, we practiced that too. That was something that's why the fall to me was the most fun that I had, was the fall. Because you didn't have to care about winning and losing. It was development. You would practice what you believed in. If it meant benching a guy in a scrimmage, hey, that's great. It's not going to cost you. But he learned a lesson, you know. So there again, we practiced all that stuff. So when they got into the competition, it was not a surprise to them.
You had an opportunity to coach quite a few guys that went on and played professionally. What was the difference with those players?
Well, I think one commonality was if you were an infielder, they wanted more ground balls. Okay. They wanted more, and they wanted to be challenged a little bit more. I had some really good infielders and several, you know, went into pro ball. Some even went into the big leagues, but they wanted more work. Hitting wise, you know, they may want to stay after. They liked the competition. I mean, they didn't like losing. You know, each player is a little different with that. Some players, it hurts more than others. I always used to tell the guys, I don't expect any of you to take losing like I'm going to take it, because this is my job. But, you know, I don't want to see any giggling or laughing or joking around after a loss. You know, on the buses, you know, bus ride, if we lost the game, they understood what the etiquette was. There again, if we won, I wanted them to celebrate too. But there was a difference between the winning and the losing. And I felt that you could, the guys pick up on that. They really, hey, you know, he wants to win. So let's, if we want to have a better time, let's buy into this. And so, I felt that was a help for us.
I feel like they can take anything and turn it into a competition, the good ones.
Yeah.
To make it more fun.
Yeah, well, they like the tougher situation. So, for example, I had a guy named Kevin France, and Kevin currently is the Washington Nationals analyst. He does the TV and stuff. And he came from a parochial school, Bellarmine Prep, which is an outstanding baseball team program. And he was a four-year starter for me. I missed his junior year. That's the year I missed with I had cancer. I missed that year. But he stayed his senior year partially so I could coach him again. I always was really proud of that. But he wanted to hit. When we played Rice, Wayne had the pitching staffs there that were illegal. I mean, these guys.
There's four big leaguers on that staff.
Oh, my God.
That was the year that I think they were all three were in the top in the first round.
Yeah. First five picks. And so we had to face those guys, and Franson loved that. He wanted to hit against those guys, and he would have his best days against those guys. And Wayne Graham, when we were at the all-league meeting, he would say, man, that Franson, he has no fear of those guys. We tried to, you know, go up and in on him. He didn't give an in. I mean, there again, just like you said, there's a special chromosome those guys have that might be a little different.
That year with cancer, did it recharge your batteries at all to come back?
Well, you know, I was fortunate to come back. The cancer that I had at the time, I had never heard of. And, you know, I was diagnosed in November of 2002. And we had had a six-year run, Ryan, where the program was really playing well. The fruits of our work were coming into play. And so I was ignoring a lot of the symptoms that I had. I was not feeling great. I was breaking ribs very easily. I mean, I was fungoing one time, and the guy who was my feeder, Mickey Manzo, he goes, Coach, what was that? And it was, I had snapped a rib. And I had a series of those. Finally, I said, hey, you know, this isn't natural. And eventually, our team doctor had me do a CT exam, like an MRI. And, a week later, I went to saw him, and he basically told me what the deal was, and it wasn't good. And then the following week, I got a doctor, a real good cancer doctor. He explained the deal. So coming back eventually became a goal of mine. But at that time, it was like, can I get out of this thing alive? Because the first thing the doctor told me is don't read the internet. You know, do not get on the internet. And I think he told my wife that too. She accompanied me on, you know, every meeting. And, Baseball America, I'll never forget the head writer at the time at Baseball America, really good guy, and his name will come out, but he called me in my office, and this is, he heard about it. He said, Coach, I'm really sorry about this. You've had a really good career, and I'm sorry that, you know, it has to end. And I said, well, hold on a second now. I said, he goes, well, no, I read about what this disease is, and I said, well, I don't want to hear any more about it. And he goes, okay. And, when I ended up coming back coaching you know, can't remember exactly when, 12 months later, 14 months later, he called me and he said, hey, I didn't mean what I said. So it was a very tumultuous period that we went through. But in the back of my mind, coming back was a motivation. I wanted to come back. You know, I mean, every day, yeah, you wanted to live for your family, but you also wanted to get back and do what you wanted to do. So I was fortunate that I was able to do that.
How do you stay positive in that situation?
Well, there again, you know, don't read the internet, which of course I never did. The gut punches were when you would read the paper. I always read the paper, and you'd see where somebody died of that illness. So at the time I was diagnosed, Mel Stottlemyre and Don Baylor had been diagnosed, okay? And I followed their progress. Stottlemyre, I believe, was the pitching coach with the Yankees at the time. Baylor was at either the tail end of his career or getting into, I don't know if he managed or not or whatever, but I followed their development. You know, there were some people that died of it. And every time you read that, it was very discouraging, very discouraging. Because you, Geraldine Ferraro, you remember, she was a politician. She was a benchmark for that. She survived 17 years. And so that was a deal where, hey, she lived this long. Because, you know, the doctors would tell you, hey, if we can get 5 years out of this. And I'd shake my head and say, 5 years? I can remember at Stanford when I was part of my wife and I went up, we were part of an experimental group, and, you know, he had to sign all this stuff, and she goes, you understand this, and blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, I do. I know what I'm getting into. She goes, man, you seem like you're not. I go, no, I'm really nervous about this, but my profession, I had to find a way to win. I mean, my whole career is I have to find a way to win. So my situation was like this, Ryan. It was like I'm down by four in the bottom of the eighth, and Rivera from the Yankees came in for a six-out save. Okay, they didn't save him for the ninth. They brought him in the eighth. So I had to overcome a four-run lead against him in two innings. That was the situation I was in.
Yep. What does going in the ABC Hall of Fame mean to you?
Well, you know, obviously, big honor. I mean, you know, it's something you don't even really think about, consider. When you get into coaching, those things never enter your mind. And to be honest with you, you know, until I was nominated by our SID, I never really gave it that serious a thought because of the great, great, great names that are in there, the great coaches. And I coached against so many of those guys and had great respect for them. So, you know, when I did get a phone call, I was actually watching Sunday Night Football with my son and got a call. And it was very, and I've been lucky. I've been, you know, the last few years I've had some of these. This one hit me the hardest. Because of it's like your peers selected you, okay? It was like the people that you had to compete against felt enough about you that you should be in their club. So that's the best way I described it. I'm extremely honored.
At what point in your coaching journey do you feel like it's now time to give back to future generations of coaches and players that are coming up?
Well, that's what I do now. That's why I do now. I spend time. I'm like a more of a grandfather coach than a father coach. When I was a head coach, I was a father coach. So a little stricter, right? A little bit more demanding. But now I'm more of a grandfather coach. So that doesn't mean I'm not going to correct them on stuff. But I'm a lot more supportive in terms of patting them on the back and trying to get them through a situation. And understanding the value of teamwork and being unselfish. You know, I want them to always be a good teammate, try to teach them what that means. And there again, the people I'm with over there at MIDI do a fantastic job. And that includes my son. They are they're very supportive of the kids. They have a good group. It's a parochial school. They're top-notch individuals, but they have some great leadership there. So I just try to augment that. I try to one-on-one more. That's what I do, more one-on-one. When I was more of a group coach, as a head coach, you know, I believed in meetings and briefings, and I felt you could accomplish a lot if you could talk good and your content was good. You can get points across. But I'm more now just an individual with a player.
How do you relate being a good teammate? Because it's not like being a buddy. Like, it's hard to be a good teammate sometimes.
Well, you know, first of all, you got to wish good things for that teammate. So I always used to tell the backup player, never wish ill on the player ahead of you. In fact, support that player more. So when he comes off the field after doing something well, congratulate him. And if he doesn't, you know, try to pick him up. So don't sit there and now I can get in. That to me is a big step in just making sure players understand that the karma part of this is real. And if you're not hoping your teammates do well, you're jealous of their, then it'll never work out.
And it comes back to you at some point.
You better believe it. And so that to me, it needs to be explained, because I think it's very natural. Because, you know, a parent wants their son to play, maybe at home. He's getting that pressure at home. I remember at Willow Glen, one of the meetings I had with the parents, I said, listen, you can help me at the dinner table. And what I mean by that is, I want your sons to be comfortable telling you why they're not playing. I don't want them intimidated when you say, why aren't you playing, that you're going to come up with a cockamamie excuse, that you can say, hey, Joe's a little bit better than me right now. And the parent accepts that and encourages you. So a parent, especially at the high school level, you know, they have to know what you're doing, why you're doing it. That's why I had at Willow Glen parent meetings all the time, because I wanted them to know why we were doing what we were doing with their sons, because we wanted to develop their sons more than just players.
Do you have another fail forward moment, something you thought was going to set you back? Could be professionally, personally, but it helped you move forward?
That's a good question. I not getting paid when I started, my friends could never understand that. They could never understand that. So after my first year as the freshman coach, the guy who helped me, he was a great friend, we were in each other's wedding, he said, you know, Sam, I got to go get a job now. And why are you doing this? You're not even getting paid. And I heard this from different friends. You know, you're putting in all this time and you're not getting compensated. My dad told me one time, because I asked him what he thought. You know, my dad had an eighth grade education, worked in the cannery as a foreman for 43 years, but he was street smart. He said, you know, what you're getting right now, you can't buy. You're getting experience to make decisions where other coaches who are getting paid, they're more or less not doing those things. You're learning on the fly. If you're any good at this, you'll get a job someday. I mean, those are great words from my dad. But that was a challenge, because this went on for, you know, my last year at San Jose State, the AD called me in and said, hey, I have $4,200 for you. Bob Murphy, the AD, the former Stanford baseball player, he was our AD. He says, I have $4,200 for you, but I have a question. How do you want it? Do you want it in 5 months or in 8 months? And I was so excited. I said, let me get back to you on that. And I actually went home, and I think I told my parents, I told my now wife, I said, should I do it in 5 months or 8 months? And I look back on that, and I laugh, because it's $4,200, but I felt like a millionaire.
Love it. Have your routines, morning or evening routines, changed over time?
Well, you know, I read the paper. Okay, I have apps and stuff.
You still get a hard copy newspaper?
Oh, absolutely.
Love it.
Absolutely.
Love it.
No, but the San Jose Mercury, the San Francisco Chronicle. That's a 2-hour and 3-hour on Sunday job. And unfortunately, the papers are a day behind now. They're not like it used to be. The scores, that's why, I have major league apps and this and that. I get the box scores. The paper's a day later, but I love reading the paper. So that's kind of what I do in the mornings. Baseball, of course, in the afternoons. My wife and I, we have a grandson that we babysit 3 to 4 days a week. I mean, I help my wife. She's the one that does the bulk of it, but I help. We spend a lot of time with him. He's only 4. He's in pre-K, but he's a blast. And then I love watching sports. I miss baseball. I watched every inning of that World Series. I thought it was one of the great World Series that I can remember.
It is. It was, wasn't it?
Oh, man. And, most of my friends don't like the Dodgers, but I said, no. I just love... This is great baseball, even though I thought Toronto, outplayed them for most of that series. The Dodgers have so much talent, they could, win playing a B game, right? Not too many teams could do that. But what a great series.
And every time you think baseball's dead and going away, it reminds you that it's not dead. It's as good as it's ever been now.
Well, and when you get into the playoffs, you see a big dynamic change. They start 2-strike hitting. When during the season, maybe they're not fouling off a pitch. You watch them; they never make a mistake throwing to the wrong base. The pitchers are on, ready to go, and I mean the attention to detail is unbelievable, and that's why the postseason is I love watching.
And it's still the small things that matter: base running.
Yeah.
Those are all the things that win and lose you games in championship time. And it showed up, base running mistakes made the difference in that World Series.
When you think
And everybody was on the play at the plate, but, the only thing is run through, don't slide in that situation, run straight through.
Well, there were two things. You're right. I'm glad you brought that up. There are two things that stick out on that play is the runner at third could have had a bigger lead. Okay. Muncy was shaded more toward the middle, which gave that. They were afraid of the back pick. Yeah. They were afraid that because the catcher liked to back pick, and there was some fear there. That was their rationale for not getting off a little bit more. But I thought he could have got. And like you said, if he goes through on that, he's safe.
Yeah.
He had to slow down to slide, and as it was,
it's what you always told your players: if it was quicker to slide, then they dive over the finish line in the Olympics.
Exactly. And so there was no tag evasion on that. That was just get through there, and then of course the play the night before when the left fielder made a great play.
But you still got to be chest up to that ball, and you're not going to score if that ball gets down anyway. Those are all the pre-pitch stuff as a base runner that you have to think about, that you're not scoring. Even if that gets down, you're not scoring, and you have to be chest up to the ball.
100%. And I'm not sure he checked where the outfielder was prior to the pitch.
Another pre-pitch before you take your lead, check where the outfielder's at.
And of course, when you're on second base, it get complicated and
you get caught up in the moment.
Absolutely,
and it shows you too. Even at that level, they get caught up in the moment too.
And the second baseman made a miraculous pick.
Yes,
that was. I don't think that guy had a series to remember.
Yes.
and so that's the beauty of that.
Hey, what are the keys to maintaining a healthy relationship in baseball? It's really hard to do, but you and Joanne, you guys have a great relationship.
Yeah, well, she's deserves better than me. That's for sure. That's a fact. But she was very supportive, has been her entire, since we've known each other. We've been married 45 years, but we've gone together for 3. And she took a vested interest in it, and she was a support base for me. She was. She encouraged me, even though, early on she was the breadwinner while I was trying to, earn a penny. And so I was very lucky. While she worked, she raised our kids and ran the household, and you know, that's hard. It's coaches' wives, it's very, very difficult. I think one of the things I regret is, you know, the losing part at times, carrying it home. And I wish I didn't do that.
That's later, easier said than done, though.
I know. And so one of the things I tried to work on was stay a little later at work and try to get that feeling out of myself before I went home, because it's not that easy just to forget it. It's not an 8-to-5 job. It just isn't. And we're all invested in this, right? I mean, our record dictates kind of who we are, at, right or wrong. That's the way it works. And we put so much into it. And there again, I think, you know, Joanne understood how much I put into it and how seriously I took it. So I had to respect her for that.
What are some final thoughts before I let you go?
Well, there again, I'm extremely honored, Ryan, to be talking to you and to be involved with this thing. I'm looking forward to seeing some old friends that haven't been to the convention in a long time. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of those people and shaking their hand. And I hope my family has a great experience there, because we're looking forward to it.
I think it's the best thing we do.
Well,
just seeing the families like that.
Yeah.
That's a big, you know, because we see it all the time with our board members is, I think family members don't realize what you did as a coach. And then you get in these situations and then the light bulb goes on for them in those situations, which is awesome.
Well, you know, there again, I'm going to start working on my speech here in the next week or so. And
well, hopefully this was a good reminder for you to get going on it.
Yeah, no. And you know, that we got a note saying, you know, 8 to 10 minutes. And because somebody had run 42 minutes or something.
Yes, it's important. That's also why I started doing these too, because I hadn't really done them before I got here, and I wanted to give everybody an opportunity to tell their stories.
Well,
and for people to hear everyone's stories more at length than trying to get it done in 5 to 8 minutes.
Well, you allowed me to do it on your show, and I'm there again. When you get to be my age, you have a lot of people to thank.
Yeah.
You know, that is the biggest thing, is making sure you can't name everybody, you know, but I have to at least acknowledge, you know, people that helped me. It's not about you. It's about the people that put you in that position. So that's what I'm looking forward to doing.
Thanks for your time, Sam. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Ryan.
I'll see you in Columbus.
I appreciate it. Okay. Thank you.
Coach Peraro is another reminder of the great coaches we've had in the history of the game on the West Coast. Truly amazing the job he did building the programs at Mission and San Jose State. So happy for him to be inducted into the ABCA Hall of Fame. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, and Matt West in the ABCA office for all the help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok, coachb_ABCA, or direct message me via the MyABCA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you.